You are listening to the Venture Scale SaaS Operator, the podcast where we interview founders who are actually in the trenches. We talk about the transparent journey of how they built their SaaS companies, how they grow them, and what they would do differently if they would do it all over. Hey folks, with us today, Julio, founder of Abacum. Super happy to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a blast.
Awesome. Let's start with the most important thing. What is your startup and who is it for?
Abacum is the most scalable financial planning and analysis platform. So we work with finance teams in companies in the mid-market so that they have all the metrics that matter from all business systems in one single place. And then we make it very easy for them to report, forecast, budget, and run scenarios engaging with all the stakeholders across the company.
How did you initially find that problem?
Look, I've spent many years in finance, both in operational roles in the trenches and also in investment banking and advisory roles. So I was trying to redeem myself in a way. Then I transitioned into tech. I started building fintech products from scratch, launching them to market. And in that dynamic of building products and launching them, I realized, wow, I'm suffering this pain of FP&A, but actually it's a pain I understand very, very well, given my previous, let's say, dark past. So I felt, hey, I have an unfair advantage and I understand this problem space very, very well from all my time in finance. So long story short, I started running a lot of user research to understand industries, company sizes, like different nuances as to, you know, where are really people bleeding in the head and what was the market opportunity. And in those conversations, actually, you know, I came across with my co-founder, George. He's been in finance forever as well, CFO and COO in unicorn companies like Travelberg and some others. And hey, we decided to partner. So I think both come to this with a very deep understanding of the user and the problem we want to solve for. So yeah, to your question, like we care a lot about the problem and we are building the product we wish we had when we were in the trenches.
Makes a ton of sense. And then tell us the founding story. How did you get the company off the ground initially and then end where you're today, basically?
Yeah. So, getting the company off the ground is always difficult. So I remember doing a lot of research and prototyping and early MVPs and talking to a lot of people, including George and after with him before actually leaving our jobs. Look, I have three children. I have a little bit more gray hair than I would love to have. So honestly, I had to pay some bills, right? So I was doing both at the same time to make sure we tested the waters. My co-founder also has three kids. So, I think we were on the same page. Look, and then we had made significant progress actually until we decided to launch, but that was precisely the first week into COVID. So I think this is also our story where, you're having this conversation with your wife. Yeah, I've been working like two jobs for a long while. It's time to launch. And then the world is melting. Remember back then, right? First week into COVID, yeah. Everybody on a lockdown, a lot of uncertainty, venture capital players running, headless around, trying to understand portfolio companies, trying to understand the new dynamic. And hey, it all ended up very, very neatly with a huge bubble, actually. But hey, at the beginning, there was no capital. It was very difficult to hire people, right? Remember back then when, Zoom was not a thing yet. Like you people were not hiring over Zoom, right? Like you had to see people, especially your early employees. Imagine that. So that was definitely a great story as to how we took the company off the ground. Landing our first customers also remotely. And those were sophisticated companies in the mid-market, right? So we tackled companies in the mid-market. So, definitely over 100, 200 employees. So most of them. So like these guys are demanding, and they require a lot of staff. So definitely it was a push.
If you need to hire the right developers and ship fast, then React Squad is for you. A boutique agency that specializes in React and only works with fast growth startups. Visit reactsquad.io to learn more.
Quick question on getting the first customers. I mean, on the you have a ton of experience and I would guess also a ton of networks. So were you able to leverage the people you met throughout like the decade before, or how did you make that initial push into market?
100%. So it was all both my co-founder and I had, luckily, you know, good networks, and you know, that you obviously get through hard work during the years, right? And then when you people in several geographies, like not only in Europe, but also in the US, some other markets. So we went through that. Of course, you need to offer value, right? So just network doesn't make the cut, to be frank. But hey, it's open source, right? So you get those first conversations going. Obviously, you need to move very fast, build very fast, make them feel they are this design partner that you are co-building with them, like all the story. And I'm sure you've heard the same thing many times. But yeah, it was founder-led through network, but also with tons of pressure to really live up to the promise.
Love that. But yeah, I can fully understand the pressure part, because even I would bet even with a big network, like people don't just like hand you money and contracts. So how did you fund the company? I mean, you're a venture back, but like walk us through the funding journey, maybe from the perspective of a founder who's maybe had an angel around, but like never had VCs invest. So like walk us through your funding journey.
So, look, we went and did a pre-seed round, and that was half of it angel money and half of it up to funds, one from London and one from Spain. So I think it was very important to us to have somebody international already in London and somebody local with operational capabilities, right? So this is where we got somebody very close to the business, super strong in product, that has then afterwards been instrumental in our story. So I highly recommend when you go early on that you try to play, you know, somebody international with that network and connectivity, but also local people with operational capabilities that make the difference when you build the business, right? And have been there, done that, and can guide you a bit better. Also, angel money, as you know, obviously, you know, good names, so you can do it for the brand or for also the advice. And I think we struck a good balance of both. Then we went through Y Combinator. So that's our next event. So I think 6-9 months later, after that round, we applied to Y Combinator. And hey, we were very lucky. We got into it. Obviously, it's super selective. And back then, the batches were actually smaller than now. So we felt super privileged. And to their credit, they run an amazing program. We learned a lot. They gave us advice that maybe we didn't follow all the time, only to realize, you know, years later, that fuck, like, you know, they were right. They were right.
Maybe quickly, you know, to double click on that, because I think, as you said, like YC is super selective. Most people will, like 99.9% will never go through YC. And I think most people maybe don't even know a founder who went to YC. So what are like the two or three things that really got ingrained in you in terms of advice in YC?
Some of it is simple. That customer obsession and really working very closely with your customers with, you know, they have some methodology and I think it's pretty public, but when you work with their partners to uncover some of the customer problems, that was very instrumental for us as well. So that's the first point. The second point is that scrappiness and an authentic approach to entrepreneurship. So they are, it's an amazing logo, right? But they are far removed from the founder. Like the more you raise, the more successful you are. Like they actually encourage you don't raise a lot of money. you are very cautious, like you build a sustainable business. And that was actually all the way through the bubble, right? So they continued having this pro-founder advice of don't get into this nonsense of raising money. So they are very authentic. So therefore, scrappiness, tension on resources, don't overhire, don't overspend, like just focus on your customers, solve a small problem, move very fast. And then something that it's very tactical, but something that was important in their methodology is that during the months you are there, you have weekly objectives and you review them with the partners, right, in your group. And it's pretty brutal, that cadence, right? Where you have, okay, what's the most pressing thing I need to get done this week? And I'm going to expose myself with, you know, publicly with these targets, and I'm going to commit, I'm going to solve them because this is the next bottleneck I need to solve for. And like, you know, weekly. And then I remember back then, you know, my co-founder and I used to jump into like the weekly preparation call on Sunday, in the afternoon or in the evening. And okay, this is going to be the week and this is our commitment. And then you prepare for those meetings. And it's just that velocity of really obsessing what's the next bottleneck you need to solve for.
I love that. And then I interrupted you, but continue the funding journey. So you went through YC. I guess demo day was the end of it as always. And then take us from there.
Yeah. And then, yeah, exactly. So then Creandum led our Series seed. So I love that fund. It's just the best seed and probably Series A fund in Europe, right? With the best track record, like literally across funds. Super strong team. We were very impressed by them. Hey, we met them in our pre-seed round and they passed, you know. So, you know, we were too early. But hey, they you know, obviously, you know, you get hurt, but they caused this amazing impression on us because they were super fast, no bullshit, straight to the point, like super open, transparent. Look, you're early, we don't like this, like, you know, whatever. And then they stayed close and basically they preempted. They are very aggressive in terms of moving fast. So they preempted basically our Series seed. And that was, you know, that was the end of it. And we are super happy that they're super strong. And then equally, then we raised our Series A with Atomico, also in Europe. And they were also close to us from our seed run. So we knew them in that context, although that run went very fast. They stayed close and we were super impressed with the team, how they knew the space. We also talked to other founders backed by Atomico. It's an amazing fund. So we raise our Series A from them, and that's it, right? So this is our fundraising journey.
Love that. And then, I mean, everyone raises money and that gets celebrated, but I mean, the real work begins after. So how does the team look like right now post Series A?
So we are around 100 people. We have operations here in New York, where I'm based. We have in a super stormy day today. So, you know, not very cool. Based in New York, we have operations here, about the executive team and about the go-to-market team. Then we have a go-to-market presence in London as well, and product development in different parts of Spain, where we originally launched the company. I think, you know, the product development team is top-notch, and it's based there.
And I'm always a nerd for org charts, so just so that you, to set the context here. So of those 100 people, what's roughly the split of like GTM product and then in a way ops?
I think, hey, ops is going to be 5-10% maximum. So very small. I think we keep it very lean. Product development should be still probably 60% of the company. Our product is very complex, right? So solving for, you know, multidimensional modeling at performance, at speed, you know, building a no-code data transformation, ETL layer for finance teams, building all the reporting functionality, you know, everything we're building is fairly complex. So we are committed, right? We are committed to build that amazing product. with all the flexibility, scalability, ease of use that we want to have for our users. So we continue investing heavily there. The rest is go to market. So I think in a B2B SaaS, we had a B2B SaaS of fairly predictable, right? Or like, and usually I think you want to see like maybe 30% or 35% in product development. We are more in the 50-60% range. We continue investing heavily in the product.
Yeah. And then on the go-to-market side, you said mid-market. So is it more of a sales and enterprise motion? Or like how does that look like from like a buying cycle perspective?
Yeah, it's a B2B, mid-market, pre-enterprise sales motion. So we don't do PLG or anything of the sort. It's, you know, maybe more traditional. We engage with finance teams at a point in time where it hurts a lot. And yeah, we solve their pains and make them heroes.
And then again, like a super technical question. So I get like, I guess like GTM is, or I would bet it's the split of like the marketing team and the sales team. So how does the flow work? Because I think a lot of it's like memes already. They're like marketers shit on salespeople shit on marketers. So it's like very important, of course, like for those to be aligned. So how are those teams built? How do they work together? Tell us everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have on the sales side, so the composition is going to be on the closing side, account executives and sales engineers. So you know, in our product and for our motion, it makes sense to have both. So account executives, of course, they need to understand the problem very well and the product and stuff, right? But they go less deep into, you know, some of the technicalities. It's a consultative, I would say, very technical sales process, right? So the product is complex and you people don't realize, but finance is a technical persona. I mean, they are not developers, but sometimes almost given what they do in Excel, right? And in spreadsheets or in other platforms, really. So like you really need to get that nailed down, and this is where, you know, sales engineers are critical. And of course you need account executives that understand very well the pain, that can drive the commercials and all the process, but also that have that level of connectivity with finance teams and establish that credibility with. So many of our account executives come from a finance background, and then they transition to move into sales. So like, it's a sweet spot for them. Then of course, this is closing. Now let's go to pure marketing, and then we'll go to the middle, which is, you know, business development. But on the marketing side, it's a combination of inbound and investments in outbound to reach the business development team. Then we have, you know, SEO, demand generation, brand. So I think the classics, and our marketing motion is very, very strong. So it's really working very well. And in the middle, you have the BDR team, where they get in contact with warm up leads or warm up accounts that are expressing already interest, have some intent, and then we make it work.
I mean, you're at 100 people. That's like a very smooth process. But like, can you tell us a time, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where it was everything like super messy? Basically, was there ever a real war story you had to push through, either on the sales side or like on the product side?
Yeah, many war stories, and I think it never stops feeling you're at war. I mentioned the COVID story when we really launched. That was, you know, pretty brutal. You know, we spent like literally 2 months locked down at home, starting a company with 3 kids and just working, you know, 16, 18 hours per day, right? So that was, you know, that required a lot of grit and determination to not get back to your cozy job, right? And well-paid job, and say, okay, like, forget about it. This is too much. So I think it showed, you know, commitment and we build the muscle for what was coming next. I think there are always difficulties, right? So for instance, transitioning from founder-led sales to building a motion that is more scalable on the sales side, for instance, is extremely difficult. And it's, people underestimate the complexity of doing that. So yeah, happy to provide more context there. And also, of course, hiring, right? I've made many mistakes. And I need to live with that every day, right? So it was definitely my fault that I didn't understand what I needed. And I was not able to bring certain people to performance or to what I needed. So it was, of course, very disappointing to me to, fail these people and go through a difficult situation where, you are not making anybody a favor, really. So I got it wrong, actually, many times. It's embarrassing. So, yeah, a lot of learnings there as well.
I mean, can you imagine that? I think every CEO who has even a smaller company, so we're, I think, like 20 people or something, and even at our tiny size, it hits home. Is there anything specific you now do in hiring to learn from it? I mean, to be honest, like you can never have a 100% hit rate with hiring, of course. But is there something specific that you now nailed after hiring 100 people plus the people that weren't a fit compared to like the early hires?
Yeah, so the process, I mean, we've been refining the process and from the beginning. We were quite diligent with the process, actually. So I think sometimes, from the beginning, we were following a book, which is called The Who. And, we did a simplified version of that process, but still deep. So like the theory and the book and all that is fantastic. And then I'm the type of guy that doesn't really like process. And then it gets you to a certain point, but there is some other things that you really need to get right. And process doesn't solve for everything. And I think maybe we relied a little bit on following that motion. Today, I spend way more time with candidates, just understanding their motivations, understanding their grit, understanding if they have what it takes to come early stage. And build from scratch, because this is pretty much what we do, and we have a strong culture. We do have a strong culture, and sometimes people won't be a fit, right? And I spend time trying to understand if they have what it takes to be in a very demanding environment. And to be honest, everybody thinks they can. Everybody think like, and they are not trying to lie to you, right? I think one of my realizations is that, you might go for senior people or this, and they honestly think they can roll up their sleeves and be builders. But the reality is that they don't understand deep down what that means and the amount of shit and the showers of shit that you need to take to be in early stage. And they think they can, but they can't. And that's a great learning. So what I try to do more recently is just to spend more time digging into these questions.
So you basically expose yourself to them more, and then it's a bit of founder gut feeling to make that decision?
I think gut feeling fundamental these days. So you need to know deep inside, like everybody else, right? I've been building more and more confidence over time through mistakes and growing, right? And at the beginning, now I believe way more on my gut feeling, and it needs to feel right inside. Because there is no such a thing as gut feeling or intuition. That's pattern recognition, really. This is all it is. Of course, you want to, you've been exposed to many circumstances in the past, so it's just this pattern recognition that you are applying. And it's actually your body telling you that, thousands micro interactions from the past are telling you if that feels right or wrong, but it's just your pattern recognition. Of course, you need to complement that with a process, right? With an objective criteria. So you know, so you don't feel you're crazy. But the reality is that to me, that gut feeling matters as much as the objective process these days.
I love that. And I just saw that we're slowly coming up on time. So the last question, if we would record another podcast in 5 years, what do you think the company will look like then? Like if you achieve all your you set out for yourself, like where are you at in 5 years?
We are the operational planning system for all the companies in the mid-market. So we have started with financial planning and analysis, and we are really empowering these finance teams to become heroes in the organization. And we take a lot of pride in working with our customers super obsessively and continue building from them with all the complexity and the nuances that they all need. But this is just a starting point. Like the next step is to really go wider across the company and cater people, right? HR, revenue operations, marketing. Like there is a lot of planning silos in the company that are disconnected from the operational planning that maybe the COO and the CFO need to drive. So it's connecting all these dots in the company so you become that operational planning system or the backbone of what is planning and performance for companies in the mid-market.
Love that. And then finally, and most importantly, where can people find you and the company online?
Yeah, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So happy if you can engage with our content and enjoy it. There is a lot of thoughts we put into it. So Julio Martinez, CEO and co-founder of Habakkuk, you will find me on LinkedIn and you know, looking forward to engaging with you there.
And we will, as always, make sure to link everything up below. Julio, it was a ton of fun to talk to you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you like this episode, then you'll love the SaaS Operator, a weekly newsletter brought to you by Earlynode, with actionable insights from SaaS experts in the industry delivered right to your inbox every Tuesday for free. Visit earlynode.com to subscribe.